All right, good evening, everyone. Welcome, and thanks for your patience. Having taught in this room before, I can tell you all the clocks are wrong, so we're not quite as late as it seems. But my name is Danny Hoffman. I'm the director of the Henry M. Jackson School of International Studies here at the University of Washington. Welcome to this fifth talk in our War in the Middle East series, The Regional Repercussions of the War. We're honored to have Dr. Mark Lynch here from the other Washington, where he is a faculty member at George Washington University. And you'll have to get him to tell you the story of how he got here. It was quite an adventure, heroic efforts to be with us here tonight. So we're grateful that that you made it. Okay, I'm gonna get down here because unfortunately the lav mics are the only ones connected to the microphones. So I'll be as loud as I can. Does that work? Okay. Good. Yeah, it's a shame I'm this tall. So let me begin, as we always do at our Jackson School public events, by acknowledging that we are on Coast Salish territory, the traditional homelands of the Duwamish, Suquamish, Tulalip, Muckleshoot, and other indigenous peoples. The Jackson School understands that the international community includes sovereign American Indian tribes, First Nations, and other indigenous peoples across the world. Now, once again this evening, I'll shortly turn the microphone over to Dr. Rashad Kasaba, my friend and colleague from the Jackson School, to introduce Dr. Lynch and to moderate this evening's event. But before I do that, I want to just remind you, as we have been throughout this series, we'll be using slido.com for our questions. So whether you're watching online here with us, whether you're watching online or you're here with us, if you'd like to ask a question, go to slido.com, slido.com, and type in the event code hashtag MLynch, MLYNCH. Now, I know that many of you have been with us for multiple events in this series, and so you've seen that each of these conversations really takes a good deal of hard work, preparation, and support. So on behalf of everyone in the Jackson School, I'd like to thank UW President Cauce, Provost Serio, everyone on their staffs who have supported this series. I'd like to thank the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, Diane Harris, and the Dean of Social Sciences Division, Andrea Woody. We've had support from both the College of Arts and Sciences Communications and Advancement Offices, for which we are all very grateful. Special thanks to everyone at the Jackson Foundation for their partnership and support. And within the Jackson School, my gratitude to the faculty and staff affiliated with the Middle East Center, Strom Center for Jewish Studies, the IT and communications teams, and especially our communications director, Monique Thorman. Now, and as I have at all of these events, I really want to thank you all for being here, being invested in thoughtful public scholarship, and taking the time to join these conversations. One quick final announcement. Sadly, our speaker for next week, Amanda Sloat, is unable to join us after all, so we won't have that event on February 20th. We will, however, be back on February 27th for our talk with Ambassador Daniel Kurtzer, Israel-Hamas, Will This Be the Last War? And that event will also be in this room. And so with that, I turn things over to Dr. Rashad Kasaba.
Well, thank you, Danny, and thank you all for coming. So I'm very pleased that Mark Lynch is with us. He's a professor of political science and international studies at George Washington University, where he's also the director of the Middle East Studies Program. Mark does a lot, and those of us who are trying to teach and run various programs, it's really amazing the number of things that he does. I don't have time to go over them. But I want to give a special shout out to Project on Middle East Political Science, which is known as POMEPS. And it is he's the founding director of this, and this has become a very important network that brings together cutting-edge research on Middle East politics. And what's interesting about this is that he brings together scholars who do work on the Middle East, but also scholars who do work on the Middle East in the Middle East and North Africa. So it is one of the most important networks of scholars, I think, especially for younger scholars. So I think that is really an amazing endeavor. Mark is also a non-resident senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and he's a frequent contributor to foreign affairs, foreign policy, good authority, and other public forums. He is a scholar of Middle East politics, Arab media and public opinion, Islamist movements, and public diplomacy, and has written books, articles, and op-ed pieces on all of those topics. Mark is especially good at understanding the link between domestic politics and foreign policy of the major countries in the Middle East and North Africa. He wrote, to my mind, the best and most comprehensive analysis of the Arab revolutions in 2010-2011. And if I ask you what Arab Spring is, most of you will know what it is, but Mark is credited for coining that term too. So this kind of knowledge gives Mark some almost like an ability to foresee things before they come. Months before the beginning of the war, the recent war in Gaza, he, along with his colleagues Michael Barnett, Nathan Brown, and Shibli Telhami, wrote a very influential article and a book on the diminishing possibility of a one-state solution, two-state solution in Israel-Palestine. And days after October 7th, he wrote another article in Foreign Affairs, which was an invasion of Gaza would be a disaster for Israel. So I am very pleased that he is here for us to discuss the regional implications of the ongoing war, and I'm looking forward to his presentation and the Q&A afterwards.
Thank you for that, those kind introductions. The Arab Spring thing I'll never live down because it made it into Wikipedia, and it was one of the greatest lowlights or highlights of my life when it was assigned to my son in his introduction to international relations course. So he tried to hide. At any rate, thank you so much for being here. It really is a pleasure to get out here to Seattle. I used to come out to the Pacific Northwest a lot back before COVID. This is my first time back. Last time I was here in the University of Washington, I was hosted by dear friend Ellis Goldberg, and I very much miss him and wish he were still here with us today. I understood that this was part of a series about the war and October 7th in Gaza, and I was able to get a little preview of what the other speakers were talking about. So I'm not going to try and cover everything that every speaker talked about. I'm going to try and stick to this question of the regional dimension of the war and kind of what this means for the way Middle East politics works. And in order to do that, what I want to do is, I think, begin by just saying that for those of you who have been following the Middle East for a long time, which I assume is many of you in the room, there's a certain familiarity to the idea of there being episodic wars between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. This is something which has punctuated regional politics since the Israeli withdrawal or redeployment out of Gaza in 2005 and the Hamas seizure of power in 2006, there have been repeated episodes of encounters between Hamas and Israel, which have followed a certain script. And that script typically took the form of some crisis emerging, and then a war, an exchange breaking out in which Hamas would send missiles into Israel, and Israel would carry out an air campaign against Gaza. A large number of Palestinian civilians and infrastructure would be destroyed. There would be an international call for a ceasefire. And things would largely go back to normal. Some of those episodes were quite traumatic and horrifying. In 2009, just before Obama took office, the scale of the war was such that the United Nations appointed a special envoy to look into it. The famous Richard Goldstone report came out cataloging the scale and extent of Palestinian suffering. But after that report, which many people at the time thought was a real landmark in international justice, nothing happened and nothing changed. In 2014, there was another major episode of this, as many of you recall, in which the scale and scope of devastation was even greater. Rashad talked about my predicting the future. I wrote a piece for the Washington Post in 2014 after that called Political Science After Gaza, in which I tried to think, what is the scale and scope of this mean for how we study the Middle East and how we should be thinking about their nature of relations between Israel and the Palestinians? And some of the points I made there about the rise of the BDS movement and alienation from the two-state solution and the kind of corrosive effects of this kind of repeated episodic violence, I think more or less came true. But for the most part, things went back to normal and nothing changed. And I think one of the things we need to understand when we think about that normal and where Gaza fits into the larger equation of regional international relations in the Middle East is that there was nothing normal about the status of Gaza within the Middle East after 2005. Gaza, as many of you I think are quite aware, was under one of the most comprehensive blockades imposed on any territory on Earth ever, in which after Israel withdrew, it maintained absolute control over every point of entry into Israel, into Gaza, whether by land, air, or sea. It controlled the airspace, it controlled the movement of goods, the movement of peoples, and basically, it maintained this extremely rigorous set of sanctions and blockade with the participation of Egypt, a close American ally and a close Israeli ally. It was able to maintain this blockade. As often happens with blockades and sanctions regimes, those of you old enough to remember the American sanctions against Iraq between 1991 and 2003, you saw the evolution of ways that people in Gaza adapted to this blockade and adapted to find ways to maintain their life. In the case of Gaza, this meant the construction of an elaborate network of tunnels, the creation of a political economy, which made sure that there was enough going in and out of Gaza to keep people alive, while also ensuring that that flow of money, guns, but mostly food, medicine, everything else, went through networks controlled by Hamas. In other words, the blockade of Gaza and Hamas's control of Gaza were two sides of the same coin. Hamas was able to stay afloat in large part over the years because Qatar would transfer significant amounts of money to Gaza at the request of the Israeli government, because the general idea was that the status quo of Gaza was one which was widely understood to be immoral and unacceptable, and yet not something which rose to the level that anyone would do anything about it. In other words, this was one of those areas in international relations, one of those pockets where everybody knew it was wrong, but it was seen as containable, seen as something which was not a disruptive factor. And when war did break out, it was seen as following a fairly routine script. And that, I think, is the template. Now, this began to break down, as most of you will now remember, in 2021, when Hamas got itself involved in escalating conflicts in East Jerusalem over the confiscation of Palestinian homes by settlers. It inserted itself into this with a barrage of rockets, which generated a short-lived but somewhat different type of dynamic in which things didn't seem to be following exactly the same script. And one of the things, what I want to focus on in this talk then is what changed. What changed between 2005 and where we are now? Why is this war so different? And does it actually represent something which will fundamentally change regional international relations? Rashad talked about my writings about the Arab Spring, and while I do hate the name Arab Spring, I'm happy to embrace what I wrote in that article, which came out kind of at a point when Tunisia's revolution had gotten going, Egypt's revolution had not yet begun. And at the time, almost every scholar of international relations was of the opinion that Tunisia's revolution would not spread beyond Tunis. And they had very good arguments for that. The idea that realists brought to the table was that the forces of stability typically won. Arab states were strong. You didn't see wide diffusion between different countries when it came to protest movements and revolutions. And that basically one would expect that what happens in Tunis stays in Tunis. And at the time, I was looking at something very different from what most international relations scholars were looking at. I was following Arab social media and Arab media very closely. And what I saw was something I'd never seen before, extremely widespread identification with what was happening in Tunisia, the framing of what happened in Tunisia as part of a broader Arab story of discontent and revolution, people drawing connections and correlations between their own situation and what was happening in Tunisia. And I argued that it was likely to spread, that we were on the verge of a revolutionary moment, and lo and behold, it did turn out to be a revolutionary moment in 2011. Did it change everything? No. But within 2 years, almost all of the revolutionary changes had been reversed. Autocracy had returned to the Middle East. Many of the things that one would consider to be fundamental about Arab regional international relations went back to the way they were before. And yet, many of them didn't. And my argument is essentially that we're in a comparable moment right now. Not everything is going to change. We shouldn't expect that the war in Gaza is going to lead to a fundamental reversal of everything in the Middle East. That's too high of a standard. But I do think that some key fundamental things have changed at the global level, at the regional level, within Israel-Palestine, and within domestic politics within Arab countries. And I think that we would be foolish and complacent to assume that we're going to follow the old script, that we're simply going to go back to the way things were. I can tell you from spending far too much time with them that most people in Washington still assume that we are following that script. And they still assume that basically at some point there's going to be a ceasefire and we'll go back to business as usual and we can carry on with the things we were trying to do before, mostly get normalization between Saudi Arabia and Israel, which for some reason is the great obsession of Washington. I'll talk about that in a little bit. But the idea is that we're still following the same script, that nothing fundamental has changed. It's been unpleasant, it's been untidy, it's sad that a lot of children have died, but ultimately, nothing has really changed. I think they're wrong, and I think they're wrong for the same reasons that they were wrong in 2011, the same reasons they were wrong about the invasion of Iraq in 2003, and it comes from the same assumptions about the Middle East that they don't want to rethink or challenge. So let me try and redeem that rather large claim. Let me start by talking about what regional international relations used to look like, and what is the normal, what is the status quo from which I think we are going to see major deviation. And I would say that the status quo of the Middle Eastern regional order was largely set in 1990-91, after the liberation of Kuwait from Iraq and the Bush administrations, followed in short order by the Clinton administrations, active efforts to create a Middle Eastern, depending on which side, where you stand politically, you might call it an imperium, you might call it a regional order, you can call it whatever you want to call it. This was a regional system based on U.S. primacy, one in which the United States used the moment of the liberation of Kuwait when it had a truly impressive ability to mobilize international consensus via the UN Security Council, a large international coalition in defense of the norm of sovereignty to reverse the Iraqi invasion and conquest of Kuwait. The Bush administration, seeing this unfold simultaneously with the collapse of the Soviet Union, saw the opportunity to rewire the Middle East around U.S. primacy. Now, these days, we are so used to the idea of U.S. primacy in the Middle East that we don't really, well, some of you in the room might, but most people don't really remember a time when the Middle East was not a U.S. imperium. They don't realize that before 1991, we didn't have any military bases in the Middle East. We didn't have a large active military presence. That is all post-1991, when the United States became actively, deeply embedded within the structure, the architecture, and the deep political DNA of the Middle East. Before that, it was the Cold War. Cold War ended, Iraq War gave the opportunity, and the United States rewired the Middle East around U.S. imperium. That meant the creation of a large number of military bases, which continue to exist to the present day across the Gulf, Jordan, spread out throughout the region. These were done in order to enforce the sanctions against Iraq, to maintain the dual containment of Iraq and Iran, which at the time were called rogue states, meaning they were outside the U.S.-led regional order. And the idea, the key motivating idea, was that the United States needed to find a way to balance its two major alliance systems, its alliance with Israel and its alliance with a set of Arab states which were technically not at peace with Israel. Now, the Carter administration did a great thing in 1979 with the Camp David Accords, bringing about peace between Egypt and Israel. But it was only after 1991 that spread beyond the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty. The key thing about the peace process, which George Bush initiated and Bill Clinton carried forward after the Gulf War, was that it was in very large part designed as a way of lubricating an alliance between, or at least an alignment between, friendly Arab autocratic regimes and Israel. The peace process, the attempt to create a two-state solution, the attempt to find some way to recognize both Israel's security and Palestinian aspirations, was seen as the necessary condition to cement an alliance led by the United States and incorporating both Israel and key Arab states. This has been the most consistent feature of Middle Eastern international relations and regional order since 1991. We have been involved in a peace process. I'm terrible at math, but 1990 to 2023, we're talking roughly 2024. So we're talking over 30 years of some form of peace process. Whether or not there are actual negotiations, whether or not there is actual peace, the aspiration for peace is, in a sense, been seen consistently as a necessary condition to maintain cooperation and coordination between the United States, Israel, and the Arab states. And that has been consistent across all administrations. There is nothing radical about it, whether Trump does it, Obama does it, or Biden does it. This is essentially the this is the necessary condition for the maintenance of U.S. primacy and U.S. order. And a lot of us have forgotten how close it actually came. I was living in Jordan, I was living in Palestine, I was living in Lebanon in the 1990s. I spent time in Ramallah, I spent time in Jerusalem. You could see changes on the ground in the 1990s as you went from Oslo I to Oslo II, as you saw the emergence of the infrastructure of the Palestinian Authority, as you saw kind of the movement towards something like a two-state solution. But as we all know, and we can talk about this later if you want to, as we all know, that failed. And it failed quite dramatically in 2000. And I would argue there have been no serious peace negotiations between Israel and Palestinians since 2000. Again, not great at math, but we're going on 25 years of a peace process without any peace negotiations. Nonetheless, the aspiration for such peace negotiations continues unabated. Listen to the rhetoric of the Biden administration over the last month. All they talk about is how Gaza is going to become an opportunity for a return to a two-state solution, a return to negotiations, the possibility of two states emerging from the ashes. I would argue, and in fact, I do argue, in the next issue of Foreign Affairs coming out a week from today, you'll see that Shivitat Hami and I argue that this is a delusion and intentional obfuscation to hide what's really going on, where there is absolutely zero possibility of a two-state solution emerging from the Gaza war. But it remains necessary to pretend, because you can only get Israeli-Arab cooperation with the pretense of the possibility of peace with the Palestinians. That's fading, and I'll talk about that more in a minute. But let me just really quickly, really, really quickly say, Bush administration, Clinton administration established these conditions. The 1990s are the high point of this American-led regional order. And this included the peace process, which was quite successful up until it wasn't. It included the dual containment of Iraq and Iran. It included completely ignoring questions of democracy and human rights in favor of maintaining cooperation with friendly autocratic regimes. And the entire idea of those years was one in which you had a regional order composed of American allies who had decent relations with Israel, united against those who were outside of this network, Iran, Iraq, Syria, and then the non-state actors, Hamas, Hezbollah, and groups like that. Again, this has been remarkably stable. This was, largely speaking, the regional order and the American preference under the Bush administration, the Clinton administration, the second Bush administration, the Obama administration, the Trump administration, and now the Biden administration. People think that there's tremendous controversy about American foreign policy and that it's really hard to understand, I mean, in the Middle East. And in fact, they're completely wrong. This has been one of the most consistent places for U.S. foreign policy anywhere in the world over the last 30 years, 34, 35, as you like. American policy goals, modalities, mechanisms, and expectations have largely not changed. But realities have changed in ways that American policy has not kept up with. And this is where the regional repercussions really come into play. Let me walk you down some of the ways they've changed. Number one, this regional order is premised on the idea of American primacy, unipolarity, and the kind of the ability of the United States to essentially be the dominant power in global politics. This is no longer the case. Whether you date the decline of American power to the 2008 financial crisis, whether you date it to Obama's unwillingness to enforce his red line in Syria, you can choose your ideological preferences about when you want to date or why you want to or how you want to explain the decline of U.S. primacy. But the simple fact is that we do not live in a unipolar world anymore. There's no rival hegemon. No other state has stepped up to replace or contest the American position. So I don't subscribe to the idea that we're currently in a Cold War with China comparable to what we saw with the Soviet Union during the Cold War. I don't believe that Russia is a meaningful competitor to the United States in global politics or in the Middle East. People in the Middle East who love China have noticed that China has had virtually nothing to say about the war in Gaza. They haven't even done anything about the Houthi attacks on Red Sea shipping, which is largely taking oil out of the Gulf to China. They've largely still sat back and let the United States try and deal with these problems. I'm not saying that the United States is now facing a genuinely multipolar world, but it is also clearly not a unipolar world. The states of the Middle East view the world now as one where they have a menu of options to choose from. It's a smorgasbord where they can play superpowers off against each other. We think of the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Israel as our strongest allies in the Middle East. Every single one of them has signed a strategic partnership agreement with China over the last 5 years. Every state in the Gulf has signed some form of major political, defense, and economic agreement with China. Many of them have signed arms agreements with Russia. When the United States refuses to sell them weapons, they get them from someplace else. Famously, when the United States attempted to rally the liberal international order against Russia's invasion of Ukraine, none of its allies in the Middle East, including Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, voted with us in the United Nations. This is a very clear situation where the U.S. might still be the most powerful state in the Middle East, but it does not enjoy hegemony. It doesn't even really enjoy primacy in the sense that we knew it in the 1990s. So that's one key thing that has changed. A second key thing that has changed is that the lines of conflict in the Middle East have become much more complex and complicated over the years. So during the 2000s, during the 1990s, you could have a pretty clear understanding of what the major dividing line in international in regional politics was. It was between, as I said, the U.S. and its allies against Iran and its allies. And, you know, I teach this stuff. I write about it. I'm all about complexity and nuance. But it's really pretty much that simple, the way that the regional order was structured. You had the axis of moderates, which included Israel and most of the Arab autocratic regimes, and you had the axis of resistance, which was Iran, Iraq pre-2003, and Syria, and then the various non-state actors that I mentioned before. And that's basically how actors in the region structured their understanding of regional politics. After 2011 and the Arab uprisings, You saw the proliferation of new lines of conflict and the rise of new great powers. After 2011, the small states of the Gulf went from being kind of small states to becoming great powers, to becoming international great powers. The UAE, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, these are not takers of US policy anymore. They're making their own foreign policies now. They are intervening all across the region in fundamental ways. If you want to understand regional international politics in the Middle East over the last decade, you need to be looking not just at US-Iranian competition, you need to be looking at Qatar and Turkey competing against the UAE and Saudi Arabia over questions of Islamism in Libya, Egypt, Tunisia, and Yemen. You need to be looking at competitive interventions in Syria between Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah trying to support the regime of Bashar al-Assad, and then competitive multiple interventions by Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, all of them backing different rebel factions, often fighting against each other as much as they're fighting against Iran. What you're looking at in the Middle East over the last 10 years, then, is the emergence of a much more complex and much more independent and autonomous regional order. And again, I want to emphasize the fact that America's primary allies within its own regional order opposed American policy on almost every issue during the Obama administration. Obama wanted to support democratization in the Arab uprisings. The UAE, Saudi Arabia, Israel, and every major American ally in the region opposed that. The United States wanted to get a nuclear agreement with Iran. All of its major allies opposed that and lobbied hard against it. The United States wanted to avoid intervention in Syria. All of its allies were pushing for intervention in Syria. The United States wanted nothing to do with the war in Yemen, and our allies wanted to intervene in Yemen. The basic point here, then, is that at the global level, the U.S. has declined. At the regional level, there's far more autonomy and far more independence and far more complexity than there was in those earlier eras. Now, within all of that, you might say, then there's Trump, and Trump changed everything because Trump is, you know, crazy and all of that. He might be, I don't know, but not in the Middle East. In the Middle East, he was extraordinarily conventional in most ways. What Trump did was he realigned the United States with all of those partners that I was just talking about. He abandoned the Iran nuclear agreement, which is what our partners wanted. He, basically stopped talking about democracy and human rights, which is what our partners wanted. He supported Israel unabashedly, discarding efforts towards a two-state solution. He stopped talking about the peace process, gambling that Arab states didn't really care either, and that they would be perfectly happy to go about a business of working with Israel against the greater threat, which was Iran. Again, none of these are unusual. They're not even crazy. They're not even abnormal. They're completely normal from the perspective of how the U.S. and Washington have approached the foreign policy, U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. And from the perspective of the Trump administration, there were some setbacks. The blockade of Qatar was really weird, and we can talk about that if you want to. But at the bottom line, Trump considers his signature achievement of his 4 years in the Middle East to be the Abraham Accords, which was the United Arab Emirates agreeing to normalize relations with Israel without there being any progress or any solution to the Palestinian issue. And this is very much in line with what every president before Trump had wanted to achieve: open cooperation between its Arab allies and Israel by any means necessary. He discarded the Palestine part, but the Palestine part was never the point. Getting the cooperation between Arab allies and Israel was the point. It is quite telling that the Biden team campaigned very hard against Trump in his Middle East policy. They campaigned about turning Saudi Arabia into a pariah for its war crimes in Yemen and its murder of Jamal Khashoggi. They talked about going back to the peace process. They talked about restoring talk about democracy and human rights. They campaigned, they talked about returning to the Iran nuclear agreement, the JCPOA. They campaigned really hard against Trump. when they took office, they governed exactly like Trump. They adopted every one of his policies. They did not return to the JCPOA, and they embraced the Abraham Accords and made their primary motivation in foreign policy trying to bring Saudi Arabia into the Abraham Accords. If you follow the news, you would know that this was the primary goal of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East for the last 2 years, was the effort to try and bring Saudi Arabia into the Abraham Accords without making any serious progress on Palestine. Okay, this might seem like a lengthy excursion before talking about Gaza, but I promise you it's necessary, because you can't talk about change without knowing what you're changing from. So, October 7th, and what brings you all here into this room? So, October 7th and the war in Gaza that followed were both absolutely stunning challenges to expectations and prevailing scripts, each of them as shocking in its own way as the other. October 7th and Hamas's attack on southern Israel was something which achieved strategic surprise in a way that we haven't really seen in the Middle East since 1973. One of the reasons it achieved such strategic surprise was because of the prevailing security concept, and because of this expectation that everyone was going to follow this same basic script and set of rules. And this, again, was not unreasonable, because that is exactly what all actors had been doing for well over a decade. So the expectation was that that Hamas would be content to govern Gaza, and that at most they would get involved in things like the summer of 2021, in terms of their aspirations to try and destabilize the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah, try and challenge the leadership of Mahmoud Abbas, and maybe bid for greater popularity within the West Bank. But that was widely seen as the extent of their ambitions, and things which could be fairly easily contained. Now, we know a lot of things now about how Hamas prepared and how they achieved the surprise that they got. There's still questions about whether they expected the outcome that they received. In other words, there's this concept that I'm sure some of you have heard before. We used to talk about this a lot in Syria policy. When we were talking about U.S. intervening in Syria, we talked about catastrophic success, where what if we intervened and Bashar al-Assad collapsed quickly and ISIS came and took over Damascus, and that was in Washington, the term of art was catastrophic success. And there's some idea out there that Hamas succeeded on its own terms far more than it actually intended. That achieving strategic surprise, upending the status quo, and taking some hostages would have been within the bounds of what they would have expected and counted as a victory. Presumably, they expected that Israel's response would mirror 2014 or 2009 or 2021. An air campaign that lasted for a week, killed civilians, destroyed infrastructure, and then ended. And that they would then be able to claim victory by virtue of having attacked Israel, punctured their sense of invulnerability, taken hostages as a bargaining chip, absorbed the counter response, and then gone back to normal. In other words, one interpretation of Hamas's motivations is that they were still playing within the same script. It's just that they succeeded beyond their expectations. I don't know if that's true. Nobody does. Because, you know, again, there's a lot of information out there. There's a lot of counter information out there. I'm happy to talk more about this if people want to dig into this. I will say that at the regional level, one of the beliefs immediately after October 7th was that Iran had basically planned and encouraged this. There was reporting about a meeting in Beirut where this was supposedly coordinated with Hezbollah and Hamas, and this was going to be a part of a multi-prong attack on Israel, which is essentially Israel's greatest strategic nightmare. Everything we've seen since suggests that that was not true. What we've seen since has been that Iran and Hezbollah alike have tried extremely hard to avoid full-scale escalation into regional war, and that they've tried to modulate the extent of escalation. For Hezbollah, this has meant a kind of a tit-for-tat escalation along the border between Israel and Lebanon. imposing quite severe costs on both. South Lebanon is paying a great cost. A great number of Israelis have had to relocate out of the north of Israel for fear of Hezbollah rocket fire and missiles. And yet, as that has gotten more and more violent and more tense, there is a very clear sense of it being modulated in a rational way by both sides to prevent it from exploding into a full-scale second front. Iran, for its part, for months has, you know, its proxies have acted in various fronts, in Iraq, in Syria, and in Yemen, and we've seen the United States has responded, as has Israel, with escalating airstrikes, taking out IRGC commanders and Iranian forces in Syria, in Iraq, and all of that. But again, this has largely stayed within what one might expect of a managed script of trying to prevent too much escalation. That's generally been where we have been. This is not the behavior one would have expected to see if October 7th were actually the launch of an Iranian-backed regional plan for full-scale multi-front war against Israel. So looking at that then, one of the things which we understand from kind of looking at the regional dimension of this is that Hamas has very few friends in the Middle East. This is something which is really important to understand. Hamas was not popular. Hamas did not have a wide range of regional patrons or popular support before October 7th. The conflation of Hamas with the Palestinians of Gaza or with the Palestinian issue more broadly is just a fundamental category mistake. It is something which Hamas itself would very much like to be true. It's comparable to Al-Qaeda after 9/11. When it hoped that the Muslims of the world would identify with it and would follow its leadership, and yet the vast majority of them simply refused to do so. They rejected its extremism, its violence, and everything else. For Hamas, it's something comparable, where they do not represent a majority of the Palestinian people, they do not represent the Palestinian issue, and they did not have a great deal of regional or international support. They were seen as useful by Israel, by Qatar, by Egypt, as ways of keeping Gaza from exploding. But that wasn't really support. It wasn't ideological symmetry. It wasn't any real hope that they would take over the Palestinian Authority. It wasn't support for their goals or their charters. It was more recognition of the reality of their dominant position in Gaza and attempting to kind of use that as a way to maintain stability and, again, prevent Gaza from destabilizing the region. And when I say that Israel was happy to do that and the United States was happy to do that, trust me, all the Arab states felt the same way. They just wanted to see Gaza stay stable, stay miserable, and not dominate the headlines, because they had their other things they wanted to accomplish. And so there was that basically shared interest across Israel and the Arab world to keep Gaza within that status quo. When the war broke out then, Hamas was not acting like as the spearhead of this large international regional alliance, far from it. They certainly, I would imagine, aspire to become that by demonstrating their ability to fight against Israel and win, by stepping up and demonstrating defense of Jerusalem, things like that Hamas certainly aspires to. But that was not their reality before October 7th. October 7th had all kinds of effects, and you've been talking about them in the other lectures in this series. I'm going to talk about a few more of them in a moment. But I think one of the biggest ones has obviously been the impact that it's had inside of Israel and the way that it's fundamentally changed the way many Israelis understand their relationship, not just with Gaza, but with Palestinians more generally. Even before the war, Israel had its most right-wing leadership in most right-wing government in its history. Long before October 7th, you saw the settler movement and the ministers associated with the settler movement pushing for wide-ranging changes in the West Bank, including the confiscation of homes, move towards appropriations of land. Way back when the Abraham Accords were first mooted in 2020, Benjamin Netanyahu was openly discussing a plan to annex the West Bank. The Emirates, the UAE, claims credit for short-circuiting this plan through its signature of the Abraham Accords. I have my thoughts on that. They're not positive. But the point is that there was already this quite clear and quite quite important trend towards the right in Israel before October 7th, where the peace camp, people who were actually committed to a two-state solution, had long since lost any real political weight inside of Israel. The Meretz party didn't even win a seat in the last Knesset. Basically, they were a non-factor politically by this point. But even with that rightward movement in Israeli politics before October 7th, it doesn't compare to what we've seen since. All of the public discourse, all of the public opinion polling, and I'm happy to talk about details if people want, but they show a truly dramatic shift towards the right in terms of what people within, what Israeli citizens, specifically Jewish Israeli citizens, consider to be possible, acceptable, and right. And in general, what we've seen is not an Israeli public which is horrified by the bloodshed and the devastation of Gaza, but rather one which, for the most part, thinks that it hasn't gone far enough. And that, in fact, there is significant, much more support for more aggressive actions in Gaza than there is for more restraint in Gaza. The polling on this is remarkable. And it's only increased since the International Court of Justice ruling about the possibility of acts in Gaza aligning with international definitions of genocide. So in general, there's been a profound rightward shift inside of Israel, which I think has to be taken into account when one thinks about what regional order is going to look like after, in terms of its possibilities of whether moving towards a two-state solution or further Abraham Accords or the like. The other thing which has happened has been that the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank has been absolutely useless. And people have noticed it. And there's been a profound delegitimation of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank since October 7th, which has, again, really undermined whatever remained of the possibility of any kind of two-state arrangement. Popularity of Hamas in the West Bank has gone up considerably, according to all public opinion surveys. Not so much in Gaza, although I have my doubts about the methodology of public opinion surveys in a situation where something like 70% of all housing stock in the Gaza Strip has been bombed and destroyed, and upwards of 80% of the population has been displaced. We have at least 30,000 dead, but that's a radical undercount because it does not include all the people who have simply disappeared, buried under the rubble of buildings after widespread, massive carpet bombing of residential areas and the intentional destruction of entire neighborhood complexes. I just don't really believe that public opinion surveys based on household information and landlines and face-to-face interview protocols are really capturing what's going on in Gaza right now. So what we know, though, is that the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank has lost a tremendous amount of popularity. Right wing has gained considerable popularity inside of Israel, and it's not just Netanyahu. He has no meaningful political rival who promises a softer policy in Gaza. Benny Gantz is the main, the stalking horse for people who want to get rid of Netanyahu, but Gantz is every bit as hawkish on Gaza as Netanyahu is. So that's the situation kind of within Israel, Gaza, and the West Bank. But what I'm interested in here, what I want to come back to in this last 5 minutes, is what that means at the regional level and for this U.S.-led regional order. Fundamentally speaking, the gamble that many people had made pre-October 7th was one which internalized the lessons of the Abraham Accords and of decades of U.S. foreign policy. And it basically went like this. Arabs don't care about Palestine anymore. Because they're too consumed with their own issues. That was the lesson of the Arab Spring. Arabs care about Syria, they care about Yemen, they care about Iran, but they don't care about Palestine. Arab leaders care about Palestine even less because all they want is to preserve their own, to pursue their own self-interest, like any other leaders anyplace else in the world. And what they want is to basically get more support against Iran, which is why they want to align with Israel and why they want stronger U.S. security guarantees. The Arab Spring is over. And basically, regimes are now stable, authoritarian, and the kind of regimes you can do business with. And that ultimately, the challenge for the United States was to make sure that China, in particular, did not manage to make inroads into the U.S.-led regional order by taking advantage of regional unhappiness with U.S. policies. This is Washington from 2000 to 2023. This is what we talked about. How to deal with the China challenge as all of the Gulf states were hedging against American leadership, how to reestablish American primacy in such a way that you could cement the alliance between Israel and the Arab states, and how can you show that you are a more reliable and better ally than China? That's what we talked about before October 7th, 2023. Since October 7th, what we have seen is that, in fact, Arab publics do care about Palestine. They always did. This was a massive category mistake that the United States made. It's always been the case that when you have a major crisis in Palestine, especially when it involves large-scale violence, that becomes the number one issue in Arab politics. No matter how much Arab governments would prefer that it didn't, they are not able to control that. And that has been episodically true. It's happened over and over and over again. I had an article in Foreign Affairs back in 21, 22, something like that, called "The Arab Uprisings Never Ended." And some people in U.S. government that I talked to, they were all, you know, we find this all very convincing, but you've got to understand that Arab leaders are not going to die for Palestine. And I'm like, no, of course they're not. But they are terrified about mass protest. They don't want people in the streets. And nothing brings people into the streets like Israel killing Palestinians in large numbers. And there is nothing that these leaders want less than Gaza dominating the headlines once more. Because they know that once you have people in the streets, anything can happen. You get 1 million people marching in defense of Gaza, you get some trigger-happy policemen, and suddenly 20 or 30 protesters get killed, anything can happen, right? They understand that. Arab leaders primarily care about one thing and one thing only, and that is keeping themselves in power. And that has been the motivating force for their foreign policies for decades. And what we saw and what we see is that with the ferocity and the force of Arab outrage over what has happened in Gaza, most of these Arab leaders are in fear of their lives. They are running for the exits in a sense. They're trying to find ways to prevent this from turning into regime-threatening instability. If you look at what's happening in Cairo right now, if you look at what's happening in Amman, if you look at any of the frontline states, you see leaders who are deeply afraid of what is coming. Almost all of them believe that Israeli intentions and actions since October 7th have, from the beginning, been designed to essentially expel Palestinians from Gaza, to create what Palestinians call a second Nakba, the large-scale dispossession of Palestinians from 1948. They believe that the plan from the beginning has been to progressively force Palestinians from the north to the south, and then to push them through the Rafah crossing into Egypt. I would like to say that I've seen anything in Israeli policy that shows that that's not the case, but in fact, everything that they have done suggests that it is. Egypt is as strong an ally as Israel has ever had in the Middle East, and it is as strong an American ally as you'll find anywhere in the region. And even Abdel Fattah al-Sisi's regime said yesterday that if Israel forces Palestinians into the Sinai, that they are going to suspend the Camp David Treaty, which would be sacrificing the single greatest strategic accomplishment of U.S. foreign policy in the region, other than possibly the liberation of Kuwait, But I actually would rank Camp David higher than the liberation of Kuwait as the greatest accomplishments of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. That would be a major change in the U.S.-led regional order. Now, will it happen? We don't know. This is one of the things which is really radically new for me as someone who's been studying this region for as long as I have. To me, the idea that the Camp David Treaty is genuinely in question is absolutely shocking. Any other time before, like, the last month or two, I would have simply said, no, that's ridiculous, because from the point of view of Egypt's regime, Camp David is the key to a strategic alliance with the United States and with Israel, and it would never do anything to jeopardize that. The fact that we're even talking about it today tells you that something fundamental has changed. The idea that we might see the relocation, temporary or otherwise, of a million Palestinians from Gaza into the Sinai Peninsula is something which is the worst nightmare of every Arab leader, every Palestinian. It's not going to solve the conflict, but it is going to set the it'll set the conditions for the next conflict. And the problem that we face right now is that there are virtually no restraints preventing that from happening. Biden, just today, as I was waiting to give this talk, I saw a story about Biden basically saying that they're opposed to the any Israeli actions which would force Palestinians through Rafah, but they're not going to do anything if they do. They're not going to suspend weapon sales or do anything really at all, which from an Israeli perspective is as good as saying, go get them, go do it. And that, unfortunately, is a problem because Israel will not listen to anybody else. And I'm going to stop with this simply to say that, again, it is not difficult for me to understand the motivations behind the Biden administration's approach to this war. Again, it is not radical, it is not confusing, and it is very much in line with traditional U.S. foreign policy. This is what my friend Martin Indyk long ago called the bear hug strategy, which is the only way to get Israel to do what you want them to do is to give them a big bear hug, show that you support them, show that you feel their pain, and then when you've reassured them, then they will listen to your advice. Then they will do what you ask only because they're sure, they're secure in your support. And so the Biden theory of the case was that Israel suffered a tremendous trauma on October 7th. It needs to respond. And the role of the United States is to protect it, to support it, to make sure that Israel can do whatever it needs to do in order to ensure its security and in order to get revenge for what was done to it. Restore deterrence, deal with the Hamas problem once and for all. And again, this was very much about Biden's theory of the case being that the U.S. must support Israel, and the way to support Israel is through this bear hug. The problem, though, is that I think nobody really anticipated the scope, scale, and magnitude of Israel's war in Gaza, the sheer scale of humanitarian devastation, the kind of rhetoric which, genocidal or not, is manifestly calls for ethnic cleansing and dehumanization, and something which has caused some of the worst suffering of any war in modern memory. Everything which we correctly mobilized against in Syria, Israel has done in Gaza and worse. The intentional targeting of hospitals, of schools, the bombing of civilian areas, the blockade preventing the entry of food, which has now caused, according to Martin Griffiths of the United Nations, not simply incipient famine, but now actual famine as people are dying from hunger. The absolute human devastation and physical devastation which has happened in Gaza is so far beyond what anyone might have reasonably expected that what looks like reasonable support, what was intended as reasonable support for Israel's legitimate aims, has morphed into a position where it looks very much like the administration is aiding and abetting war crimes in ways that make it untenable to be an American ally in today's Middle East. And so, in essence, what we're looking at is a situation where, in the absence of a ceasefire, the U.S. has done more damage to the regional order which it created than it ever intended to do or has ever done before. The rage in the Middle East is beyond what I remember from 2003 and the invasion of Iraq, beyond any of the previous wars in Gaza. It's like nothing I've seen before. And again, in Washington, there's very much a bit, not this Washington, in my Washington, there's very much a business as usual approach to this. There's a complacency to it. They're managing the problem. No regimes have fallen. Nobody has broken their alliance with the United States. The Houthis targeting oil, that was troubling. But we dealt with it by starting naval convoys, and we'll get that under control. But the idea is that this is still a controllable problem, after which things will go back to normal. What I would suggest is where I started the talk, which is to say that it's not going to lead to a total revolution. We're not going to see every regime in the Middle East falling. We're not going to see a Chinese-led regional order in the short term. But I don't think we're going back to business as usual. We're not going back to the way things were. The politicians of the Middle East who want to survive don't see this, don't see supporting this war as a way to be on the right side of public opinion, a way to maintain their political power within the Middle East, or a way to guarantee their regime survival. And they don't see the prospect for something meaningfully positive to emerge out of it. American talk of this paving the way for Saudi-Israeli normalization or for a new two-state solution falls on absolutely deaf ears across the Middle East. The designation of certain settlers, Israeli settlers, the designating them with sanctions, it was a positive move in Washington, but it made zero impact in the broader Middle East as anything meaningful. What people in the Middle East, in the Arab world, see is the U.S. rejecting calls for a ceasefire, rearming Israel, expediting ways to get them more weapons, and seeming to be completely impervious to the sheer scale and scope of human suffering, which is, it's not a good look in the Middle East. And so what does this mean for regional order in the Middle East? Nothing good. Can I see the future? I'm afraid not, but what I see doesn't look good. And with that, I think I'll stop, because I want to leave time for questions. So thank you for listening, and I wish I had better news.
Thank you very much. Am I good? Yeah. Thank you, Mark. You gave us quite a bit to think about, and we already have a lot of questions here, so I'm just going to ask them in the order that they come. Do you think there should be a ceasefire, and why?
Yes, there should be a ceasefire because we have untold numbers of Palestinian dead. And it's not just the Palestinians who've already been killed. It's the famine conditions, it's infectious disease, it's the complete destruction of infrastructure. UN humanitarian relief organizations basically say that even if there's an immediate ceasefire, that it's going to take them months to be able to scale up anything resembling a meaningful response to the scale and scope of the devastation. And again, the reason to not support a ceasefire is the idea that Israel has not completed the job. And if they stop, then you're simply leaving Hamas in place and you're going to repeat the problem sometime in the future. But the problem with that is that Israel is nowhere close to achieving that goal, even with what they're doing right now. There's been relatively limited degradation of Hamas's fighting capability. There's been almost none of their senior leaders have been captured or killed. Hamas itself is not in any imminent position of being completely defeated. And so, in essence, the counter-argument against a ceasefire means that this war will continue indefinitely. Netanyahu already talks about this continuing for months. In months, we could be looking at hundreds of thousands of dead Palestinian civilians, not just from the direct killing, as I said, but from infectious disease, starvation, the absence of clean water, the absence of medicine. So I think a ceasefire is the bare minimum for what needs to be done. What needs to be done is a ceasefire combined with a massive introduction of humanitarian relief, food, medicine, and the provision of emergency aid. Because this is not a war on Hamas. This is a war on the civilian population of Gaza. And if that's not dealt with now, none of the other things are going to matter. So I think this is an absolute moral imperative at the moment. And I think that the strategic logic of defeating Hamas first simply falls apart when you realize that we're not achieving that goal.
So this might be a difficult question to answer.
They're all easy questions.
What makes you the most worried about the future of the region?
Oh, man. Most worried about the future of the region. It's been a grim region for quite some time. In 2011, there was really great hope of the possibility of democratic transitions, and then that collapsed into civil wars, autocratic reversals. And what we've been seeing for the last 10 years now, since roughly 2013, has been the consolidation of these autocratic regimes, and the conditions that fueled the Arab Spring have only gotten worse. I mean, if you look at the combination of already terrible economies with the effects of the Ukraine war on food supplies, of the effects of the Houthi blockade of shipping on kind of global supply lines, whatever, the conditions under which the vast majority of people in the Arab world are living are absolutely horrible. They're getting worse. And so the ability of these regimes to maintain control is getting more and more tenuous by the day. You add into that the radicalizing impact of the wars, and especially the war in Gaza, and then above all, the possibility that this could expand into a war with Iran. And it's almost hard to imagine how quickly you would see the flame spread through the tinderbox. I think there's a sense that you can control and manage escalation. And I think that the Middle East so far has vindicated that. We have been able to manage escalation so far, but it's getting harder every day. I don't think people really understand how bad things are in the West Bank right now, how violent the Lebanon-Israel border is right now, or you know, kind of how hot the political climate is in so many countries in the region. And so I think I do fear that we're kind of sleepwalking into something much, much worse than we have right now.
Do you think that the reduction of U.S. primacy has impacted U.S.-Israeli relations and reduce our influence for them to comply with international law?
That's a really interesting question. I think that there was a very real sense in the Trump administration, which the Biden administration shares, that the repeated clashes between Obama and Israel were counterproductive. And the idea was that kind of the very realpolitik, realist idea that the U.S. needs to show that it supports its allies and attacks its friends instead of fighting with its allies and rewarding its friends. That was the critique of the Obama diplomacy, which I didn't really agree with, but I could see the logic of it. I think that the decline of U.S. primacy has certainly given Netanyahu and other Israeli politicians the same room for maneuver that the Gulf states have had. You know, they can go to Russia, they can go to China, they can find ways to triangulate, but the relationship is different. I think that Israel's alliance with the United States is much deeper and much more robust than America's alliances with the Gulf states. And I think that, you know, the kind of as a zone of U.S. primacy, it's much more consolidated and firm. There's basically zero chance of Israel basically, you know, becoming a Chinese ally or a Russian ally instead of a U.S. ally. It just doesn't seem plausible to anyone. So I would say that at the same time, you do have that same sense that I was describing in my talk, where the alliance and the relationship doesn't seem to give the same American influence over Israeli behavior or Saudi behavior or Emirati behavior or anyone's behavior that it used to. And so, in a sense, the ability of the U.S. to convert its strong support for Israel into influence over Israeli policies really does seem to be much reduced. And again, if you just look at what's been happening in the West Bank and Jerusalem for the last 3 years, despite what the Biden administration has said about it and done and the steps it's taken to try and prevent it, it's hard not to see that playing out. You will see people who will say, that's only because we haven't tried to exercise influence, right? You know, if the U.S. simply said, we're not resupplying your weapons anymore, no more bombs, then Israel would have to end the war tomorrow. Right? I mean, that would just be a basic fact of the fact they wouldn't have any more bombs and they wouldn't have anything to drop on Gaza. It's not rocket science. Mm-hmm. Biden's theory of the case is that that would be counterproductive, that he gains more influence over the Israeli government by maintaining this kind of strong level of support. You've seen endless stories in the media the last 3-4 weeks about how Biden is frustrated with Netanyahu. He's angry. He's, he's not able, most people would say that doesn't amount to anything until there's actual arm twisting, actual consequences. And Biden so far seems unwilling to do that. So again, we don't really know if that influence has waned because it hasn't been attempted. We do know, I would say, that the bear hug strategy does not seem to be delivering the results that Biden expected. But beyond that, it's hard to know.
So this question kind of goes a bit broader in a way and asks about the U.S. removal of troops from Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And whether this had an effect on U.S. primacy in the Middle East?
That's a really interesting question. And I would say that, as part of a broader narrative, yes, but not that much on the margins. So basically, I would say that the withdrawal from Afghanistan fit a narrative popular in the Gulf and across the Middle East of the U.S. withdrawing from the region. So it was kind of a straight line kind of story about the U.S. Not intervening in Syria. A lot of people forget this, but one of the biggest dots in that storyline is in 2019, the Houthi attack on the Abqaiq oil refineries in Saudi Arabia. It took like half the world's oil supply offline for a week. And everybody expected the United States to retaliate against Iran, and Trump said, no, I'm not going to do that, which I think was a good move, but it also fit that narrative of the U.S. is not willing to act militarily. It's not willing to exert power in the Middle East. The Afghanistan withdrawal fit that narrative. I wouldn't say that the withdrawal alone had any particular impact, but it did have impact as part of confirming this already popular narrative across the region.
And
one thing about that, which is really interesting, is that, again, this is part of the disconnect between Washington and the rest of the world, is that when you raise that argument in Washington, they'll say, it's all ridiculous. We haven't reduced any of our military commitments in the region. We have more soldiers based in the Gulf than we ever had before. And they'll talk about arms sales and all of these things, which is all true. And yet it doesn't get to that narrative. It doesn't get to that fundamental perception across the region, which is what is actually shaping many of the policies and public opinion. And to put the last question and this question together, one argument would be, and this is one which is popular in some quarters, and again, makes sense, but I think is wrong, is this argument that the U.S. defending Israel might be unpopular, but it actually strengthens America's position in the region because it shows that we are willing to defend our friends. One of the major criticisms of the United States in the Obama years was that in 2013, Obama refused to intervene in Syria to defend the Syrian insurgency. In 2015, Russia intervened in Aleppo with its air force and saved the Assad regime with this brutal air campaign in Aleppo. And the takeaway message is Russia supports its friends and the United States doesn't. And so the theory would be that now the U.S. is showing that it supports its friends, and it will ignore the world, it'll ignore the UN, it'll ignore the International Court of Justice, it'll ignore its other allies, because it will always come to the military defense of its friends. And the hope is that that will then resonate with the other actors in the region. They might hate what we're doing, but they'll like the lesson. So far, what I've seen in the region, that is not the case. What they see is that you are abandoning us, you're allowing Palestinians to be killed, we keep telling you to get a ceasefire, you ignore us, you're not a good ally, you're not a good friend, and that this is undermining the U.S. position with its allies in the region. But again, that's the argument that you'll hear being made in support about why the support of Israel is going to help us in the region. Again, I don't think it's accurate. I see no evidence of it around the region. But at the same time, they'll point and they'll say, you know, when Russia intervened on the side of Assad, it was killing the allies of the Gulf states, and the Gulf states respected Russia for it. So maybe they'll also respect us for this. Again, I don't see it happening, but that's the theory.
Well, as usual, we are running short of time. And
sorry, I'll give shorter answers.
No, there are a lot of good questions, and you can follow up some of them on email and things like that. Let me ask you a question. I'll abuse my kind of position here. Ignore all these.
Fair enough.
Very good questions, actually. So a lot of people realize that the U.S. influence is waning, especially in the Middle East, but in other parts of the world too. And you do get two kinds of reaction to this. For some people, this is a good thing. Mm-hmm. Because they never believed in a rule-based international order, and so they see this as opening up a new path, a positive change. And other people are very scared about mm-hmm. the chaos, some of which you described. And because of that, they hope, or maybe they wish, that something of what existed before will be reestablished. Mm-hmm. So where do you fall on this? Do you see this as an opportunity or very kind of a scary situation that we should all go under our covers and?
No, it's a really well framed question, and I think it gets to the heart of a lot of this, and you know I think that the in the Middle East, the U.S. led regional order has been very, very good for Arab autocratic regimes. And for Israel and for U.S. allies in the region at the state level. And it's been very, very bad for most of the people who live in the Middle East. And so, in a sense, the answer to your question depends, you know, where do you sit? You know, whose interests are you talking about? To the extent that the decline of U.S. primacy leads to state collapse, civil wars, and kind of the evisceration of international law, I think that's a bad thing for everyone. But whether the U.S. remaining in a position of primacy is actually preventing those things seems to me to be a very open question. You know, people forget that even during the peak years of U.S. primacy in the Middle East, 1991 to 2000, that's when you had the sanctions on Iraq. That's when you had, you know, kind of a lot of bad things were happening in even at the peak of U.S. primacy. I will say that one of the real tragedies of the Gaza war is that the Biden administration, I think its greatest moment in foreign policy was its response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine and its ability to rally an impressive global coalition in support of Ukraine and, as you put it, in defense of. Well, they moved away from a liberal international order to a rules-based international order. But again, this was something which was an actual attempt to assert leadership in the name of something greater than just American national interest. And I think if there's going to be American primacy that has the value you're describing, it has to be that kind of primacy. Primacy in the pursuit of some kind of greater global good. What you saw with the U.S. attempt to rally international support for Ukraine, as I mentioned during the talk, is that most of America's allies in the regions refused to join because of their interests in Russia and because of their own skepticism about U.S. leadership and Ukraine. But then Gaza came and has just put an absolute stake in the heart of the entire principle. With the U.S. supporting Israel in the war in Gaza, and with the evidence of the magnitude of war crimes and the devastation of Gaza, basically nobody in the global South will have any interest at all in anything the United States has to say about rules-based international order, international law for a long time. Nobody believes that the U.S. is defending international norms when it's enabling what's happening in Gaza. In a sense, I would say that Gaza and the U.S. response to Gaza has not just erased all the gains that Biden made in Ukraine, but it's actually taken it to a far worse place. Because if Trump had done it, everyone would have said, well, that's what we expect, right? We'd expect him to do this sort of thing. But with Biden positioning his entire global foreign policy posture on defending a rules-based international order and then doing what he's done in Gaza, I think that's worse, because this is actually a betrayal of what he said he was trying to achieve in the eyes of many people.
Well, I want to thank you very much for your talk and for your answers, and all of you for coming and listening. Thank you very much.
My apologies to your inbox.